This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. And you may reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff man is Raymond Strother, the man from Port Arthur, Texas, who is a member of the Manship School of Mass Communication Hall of Fame at LSU. Spent his formative years as a political consultant in this area, and then went on to national fame, guiding the likes of Gary Hart and Lloyd Benson and Buddy Romer and Albert Gore and Bill Clinton and many others. Good morning to you, Raymond Strother.
Good morning.
Joining us from Bozeman, Montana.
I am.
And we haven't talked with you since the election. President Obama, as the votes continue to trickle in, is now ahead by about 5 million votes over Mitt Romney, 51% to 47.3%. Turned out to be not such a close race. What happened?
It wasn't a very close race. And, you know, I think what happened, if everybody's trying to simplify it, and there are no real simple answers, but the simplest answer, the one I understand best, is that the extreme right wing of the Republican Party controls the nominating process. And all these early primaries they conducted were controlled by the extreme elements of the party. Well, to win the nomination, Romney, who I'm sure is a good man, a very bright man, and probably a capable man to be president, was pushed farther and farther to the right. He had to say more and more inflammatory things that would haunt him later. And he was, you know, he ended up not being a very good candidate. He said some things, too, that would haunt him of his own making. But I think he was pushed into defeat by his own right wing.
Now, a few years ago, you retired from political consulting on an official basis after a bruising governor's race in Georgia.
Right.
That state, where Obama didn't try, he got 46% of the votes. Romney got 53%. And it was a case in which if the president had put out an effort, he might have won Georgia. What's going on in the Deep South?
I don't think so. I don't think he would have won Georgia. Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, they're very predictable. And that's why candidates didn't campaign there. You don't campaign in places you know you're going to win or know you're going to lose.
I mean, it's just and super strong wax.
And the people who suffer from that are the people in Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, because they're taken for granted. And so I found it in advertising.
Let me play a little clip of what he said to some of his big donors. Here's Mitt Romney. Listen to this.
And the rest of the country really wasn't in the hunt. For example, I never seen Montana. I didn't see a single presidential ad. Unless I was watching one of the few network ads they ran. But we were not part of the presidential campaign here at all.
Now, that's
and,
caused a lot of
Obama
upward
did a little bit better here.
That the president gave. I guess the implication is, was he bribing some of that
Georgia.
Coalition, minorities, Hispanics? Was he bribing young women
with all sorts
of, quote, gifts? What do you make of that?
It's modern politics. It's been a huge change since I retired.
This is completely unhelpful. This is not where the Republican Party needs to go. Look, if you want voters to like you, the first thing
you most brilliant campaign I've ever seen run, the Obama campaign. But in a way, it's sad because fewer and fewer people are asked to participate in the campaign.
The party needs to go.
You know, Ohio was more important than the entire South put together. So in the next few months, the next few years, Ohio will get a lot of attention, and the Deep South will have to fight for survival, I think.
Well, Ohio has 18 electoral votes, and yet if you add Louisiana, the four states you mentioned, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, those states collectively have 39 electoral votes. And you say
that's right.
that they were neglected, as was South Carolina, as was Arkansas, as was Tennessee.
Sure. And Texas.
Yeah, and Texas with 38 electoral votes. And it is a case in which states that are considered not in play or neglected or ignored. Now, California would be the same with 55 electoral votes. Should we change the process?
Oh, yeah, the process has to be changed. First off, I'm beating a hollow drum here because it'll never happen. We need to get rid of the Electoral College. People should be elected with a popular vote. That's called democracy. The Founding Fathers just didn't have a lot of faith in democracy when they set up the Electoral College. Get rid of that first, and that would be a long way towards solving our problem. The other thing is we need to somehow rein in how much money is spent. This was a travesty, the amount of money spent. And actually, in the amount of money spent, the final result was about the way it started.
A few moments ago, you said that Obama ran the most brilliant campaign that you'd seen for president. What was so brilliant about it?
Well, let me explain it this way about the change, the transition I've seen. I'm a media guy. You know, I always prided myself on creativity and not the product of television and radio that I produced and the messages that we put together. And we use television and radio simply to convey those messages. If you noticed this presidential campaign, and I've only seen a lot of the commercials since the campaign was over, there was no brilliance. There was no commercial where somebody would say, wow, can you imagine that? There were none of those. That didn't happen. Most of the campaigning was negative. Most of the ads on both sides were negative. There were very few positive ads. And targeting was more important than creativity. It was all about who voted. And it was more about logarithms than creativity. That's why you had so few states involved. That's why that all the huge tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars were spent making sure the right people turned out in the right states to control the Electoral College. So it's changed completely. It's not anything that I celebrate, but it has changed. It's about new media now. It's about fundraising online. And it's about corralling voters and getting them to the polls. And that's what Obama did brilliantly. Their campaign was simply brilliant. And they conducted a campaign. They started it 4 years ago, actually, when they put together this beautiful organization, and they tweaked it for 4 years. And by the time the election came, Republicans were simply watching their dust. They never could catch up. They tried to come up with a sophisticated program, but they didn't field test it, and it fell on its face. But they didn't know it fell on its face until 2 or 3 weeks before the election. So they were a complete failure. They cared more about ideology than logarithms, I guess, but they lost.
Well, when you win, things look better in retrospect, and when you lose, things look much worse, and now people are saying Romney ran a terrible campaign. But on Election Day, we had Michael Medved, the esteemed conservative commentator on this show that morning. He predicted a Romney victory. Romney had only prepared a victory speech. How could they have been so wrong?
People convince themselves. I remember when I lived in Baton Rouge, and we lived on Broussard, and my wife belonged to the Bocage Tennis Club, and she played every day. And she'd come home and say, for one of my local candidates, one of my state candidates, you're going to lose. I can't find a single person for your candidate. I said, great, we'll win. And we did.
Yeah, it depends on if you're insular enough, you could either be pleasantly surprised or terribly disappointed, and apparently.
But, you know, people convince themselves. People start out, I lunch with a group of professional people here, mostly retired, called the curmudgeons, and about half of them are Democrats, about half of them are Republicans, and they're all retired judges and doctors and lawyers and that sort of thing. And before the election, they were talking about how finally they were going to get rid of Obama. Some of them were. And so I reached and pulled out my checkbook. I wrote a check for $1,000. I said, I'll keep writing these checks as a bet, and all you have to do is write a check to match it. And I couldn't get a single taker. So they were talking boldly and bragging big, but they weren't that convinced when it came down to putting money on the line.
Well, Mitt Romney makes $10,000 bets. You only make $1,000 bets, Raymond. That must mean...
Well, he has a lot more money than I. That's for sure.
By the way, I at the Baton Rouge Press Club, Joe Tragel and Pat Bergeron made a $1,000 bet on the election, and I saw Bergeron come in with a wad of cash the other day, and Tragel collected it. I hope Joe reports that on his income for 2012.
He's a good American. Yeah,
and he's a
CPA.
And
I would, too. But I would have made a $10,000 bet, but I thought $1,000 was about as far as I could push it. and I don't know if I had $10,000 in my checking account, but I didn't think it would ever come to that.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk to Ray Strother. Now, one of those to immediately denounce the Romney campaign as ineffective was none other than Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana. Kevin, do we have something from
Governor
Jindal?
This is completely unhelpful. This is not where the Republican Party needs to go. Look, we want, if you want voters to like you, the first thing you've got to do is to like them first. And it's certainly not helpful to tell voters that you think their votes were bought. That's certainly not a way to show them that you respect them, you like them. We need to stop talking down to voters. As a Republican Party, we need to fight for 100% of the electorate, not 53%, not 52%, but 100%. We've got to stop trying to divide people into different groups by race, by gender, by class. Instead, we've got to show them that our conservative principles will help them pursue the American dream, enter the middle class, do better. This is completely not helpful. This is not where the Republican Party needs to go. We need to stop being the dumb party. We need to offer...
Does Bobby Jindal have the answer?
I sincerely hope that Governor Jindal didn't bruise his neck when he turned so quickly to try to go to the middle. It didn't even take him 24 hours to moderate. He saw the future was not being an extreme conservative, and maybe 2 or 3 years ago it was. And I wasn't impressed. I got a good laugh out of it. Proved once again maybe he's a better politician than I thought he was.
Well, he talks about competing for 100% of the votes, and the governor lives within a few miles of Scotlandville, and I haven't seen him in Scotlandville in a very long time.
Hey, that's all talk. It's just talk. Somebody has to be the voice of the new Republican Party, and there are several people out there vying for that honor right now. It will be the next nominee. And he's doing the same thing some other people are doing around the country. So it's not a surprise. It happens. And on the Democratic side, too, the Democrats will take a big loss. And, well, look at Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton came back as a moderate Democrat after he had experience with Mondale and McGovern. And he came back as a moderate Democrat, Democratic Leadership Council, DLC. So it's not unusual for politicians.
Now, you handled one man who became president, and Bill Clinton, and two others who might have been president, Albert Gore and Gary Hart. Is Governor Jindal, based on your observations, is he in their league?
No. And I'd make another one of those bets right now. And I would check my bank account, and I'd be willing to empty it that he'll never be president of the United States. He's not the type of person people look for. And he's running with a spotty record in Louisiana. No matter how he tries to paint it, it's going to be a very spotty record in Louisiana. And third thing is, like it or not about my home, well, I call Louisiana my home state because I left Port Arthur, Texas, very young. Like it or not, people don't hold Louisiana politics in high regard around the country. And being a Louisiana politician is not necessarily a good mark when you run for national office.
Well, what, independent of Louisiana, the same could be said of Arkansas, I think, what does Jindal not have that Clinton and Hart and Gore did have?
You know, there's an X factor. I've always said that I've done about 320 campaigns, and when I go in to interview a candidate where we did this dance around each other, do you want me and do I want you, I could tell in about 10 minutes whether or not I had a winning candidate. It's their personality, it's their charisma, it's an unknown quantity that I've tried to write about, been unsuccessful with.
We'll be back with Raymond Strother after this timeout and take some calls after a 1 minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Raymond Strother, the guest, the well-known political consultant who spent much of his career in Louisiana and is now living in Bozeman, Montana, still teaches a class or two at Northwestern State in Natchitoches. And as I mentioned, some of his clients included Bill Clinton, Albert Gore, Gary Hart, Lloyd Benson, Russell Long, John Stennis, Dennis DeConcini, Mary Landrieu, Blanche Lincoln. And as we hit the break, you were talking about the X factor that candidates have, and some have it.
I, I just thought of, during the break, I thought of something else, Jim. This morning, even before I talked to you, it's 8 o'clock here, or 8-something here, I talked to one of the more prominent reporters in America, who's a conservative reporter. By that, he's personally conservative. I think he's objective, but personally conservative. He said he'd go, and I think it was the National Press Club last week or this week early, I don't know when it was, to listen to Governor Jindal speak, and he said that Governor Jindal had a 5,000-word speech they delivered in 30 minutes. He said it was so rapid fire that he had trouble keeping up with it, and so did the audience. So that's the X factor. And that's, remember he gave that disastrous response to State of the Union. It really hurt him terribly. Well, it appears he hasn't learned anything if he did that to the National Press Club or wherever it was, a National Press gathering, I know that. And that's the X factor. If you can't figure that out, that's the X factor.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for Ray Strother. Here is Dave near LSU. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. And Raymond, is it? Thank you. I'm afraid my comment is to you, mostly to you, Jim. That quote you've played from Jindal, I think you've done it about the fourth time now or more. And I'm not a fan of Jindal. I'm usually a fan of what you do on this show. I think it's, you're not giving the context. The context was that Romney, about 4 days after the election, made comments to his supporters, fundraisers, that Obama had bought off various parts of the electorate. And the question to Jindal in that interview was directly about that comment, and Jindal was responding about Romney's almost a retrograde thing to the 47% issue. And that is what Jindal was talking about, and I think you should make that clear when you introduce that quote. Because I totally agree with Jindal on that particular issue, and I don't see it as a retrograde on his part to the whole campaign, but just Romney's very unfortunate remarks about Obama buying off the electorate. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Well, you know, he's right, and Jindal's right. Governor Jindal's right. I'm not saying he's wrong. You do have to campaign to 100% of people. And the caller was right, too, in that Romney dug himself into a hole with that 47% comment. I mean, that was a disaster. And that comment alone could have had a lot to do with his defeat because it was a reflection on him, something that people feared anyway. And it was the drum that the Obama campaign was beating in those states that mattered, about him being an elitist and aloof and apart and not understanding Americans like you. So the caller was exactly right, and Jindal's exactly right. I just doubt his sincerity.
Well, it was one of Romney's advisors, Dan Senior, the son-in-law of Jim Brown, by the way, who said that a governor, and it was obvious which governor he was referring to, was immediately turning on a person he had supported, and of course, Governor Jindal sought to be on the ticket with Mitt Romney, but he made other comments independent of this one, Dave, that indicates that he is turning to the middle, as Raymond Strother indicated, and Jindal's a smart politician, but I don't think any candidate from the left or the right competes for 100% of the votes. You don't find many Democrats, liberal Democrats, going into Baptist churches in North Louisiana the way this governor has for the last several years, spending his Sundays evangelizing with people of a religion of which he is not. And you don't find many Republicans like Governor Jindal driving to Southern University to campaign. It just doesn't happen. It should, but it doesn't. Raymond, you generally fish where the fish are, and you go to the people who you think will support you rather than spending time with those who are not likely to be supportive.
Well, that's absolutely correct. It's, you know, it's called targeting. But if you have a group of 100 people and you spend, you know, 4 or 5 hours on that 100 people and you're only going to get one vote out, you're going to change one vote, why would you go there when you can go to 100 undecided voters and maybe get 30 of them someplace? So, no, you've got to be careful. Your most important resource in a campaign is a candidate and the candidate's time. And how they spend their time and their campaign money is really the nucleus of the campaign. And so a candidate has to spend time and money where he can reap the most votes. So, no, Governor General need not go to Southern University, in my opinion, unless he changes a lot of his policies and becomes more moderate in a lot of things he does, and particularly changes some of his education policies.
It is always impressive, though, when a candidate from the left or the right goes to places where he or she may not be welcomed with open arms. I recall Ted Kennedy accepting an invitation and appearing as the commencement speaker at Liberty University, which was headed by Jerry Falwell.
It's called counter scheduling, and we do a lot of it. One time we put Senator Hart to give an anti-Wall Street speech, and we set up our podium and our platform on Wall Street to do it. Counter scheduling is a very interesting political technique. I remember that Liberty University speech, and those things are often done, but not done as much now as 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, you've commented that when you went to Washington, in what year was it, Raymond?
I moved to Washington in 1980.
All right. At that time, how many political consulting firms were there in Washington, D.C.?
In the Democratic side, there were three of us. And, one of them was in New York. David Sawyer's in New York. Bob Squire. And I was the third, and was recognized as the third. And I had the good fortune of being one of the first there. And that was always my good luck. And by 1985, I think in 85, U.S. News and World Report ran a story about how much money Bob Squire, David Sawyer, and I had made that year. And by the end of 95, there were about 100 consultants in Washington, D.C., and now there are about 1,000 in that city alone. And you have consultants in every other state, too, like Louisiana has some good consultants. Our good friend Ray Tedley just died, but Roy Fletcher's there. There's some other people who are very good. And every state now has political consultants. So it's a growth industry.
But 1,000 in Washington alone. And Jindal's advisors are largely in Washington. And one who goes back and forth, Timmy Teeple, who used to be his chief of staff, who is head of a group called On Message. And the governor... He is very disciplined when it comes to campaigning, and for whatever reason, Raymond, he and his staff have made a decision not to talk to local media, to only talk with national reporters, and to only talk, if they can, about what they want to talk about. So if you're president, you generally have to be an open book at some point. At what point does that happen for Governor Jindal?
When you say, I'm going to run for president of the United States, at that point, you can't play those little games about who I will and who I won't talk to. Early on, Romney tried that. You know, early on in the campaign, Romney wouldn't go on any of the morning shows or any of the political talk shows, Face the Nation or anything like that. Toward the end of the campaign, he was begging to get on all those shows. It's just a lack of understanding of how politics really works and how persuasion really works. You can't turn your back on mass communications and expect to win an election. So they'll have to come around. And to shut out the local media, bad mistake. Because one thing that's happening is the national campaigns are going local. There wasn't much network advertising this past time. It was all local advertising in Ohio and Illinois and Michigan. It was local. They had local spots for local people. So I think to shut out local press is a terrible, terrible error. Clinton used to go into a town and make sure that people who were never invited to a press conference, like a weekly newspaper, got invited. So he's making an error. But again, as I said, what needs to change with Governor Jindal is Governor Jindal.
I talked with a gentleman yesterday in Arkansas about this phenomenon, and we mentioned Bill Clinton, and he said, this man did, that Clinton often met with the Arkansas media when he was running for president in 1992. He would find a way to get back to Little Rock for a few hours, and the first people he would talk with would be the local media, because he wanted to create the impression that he was everywhere, that he was doing...
Well, yeah, local media is a megaphone. They're a megaphone to the rest of the nation, and you can't do that. The greatest disgrace in running for president is to lose your home state. Well, Governor Romney lost Massachusetts, where he claimed to live. He lost New Hampshire, where he has a home.
Michigan.
He lost Michigan, where he grew up. So, you know, those are not good things to happen. So, would Governor General, I don't know who's advising him, but he better come home and start paying attention to his roots, his base.
297-5633, still time to talk with Ray Strother. HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Sir, you mentioned a few minutes ago about the mega bucks it takes to even run for office or a campaign or something like that. My question is, how much influence do lobbyists have either on a local level all the way to Washington, D.C. on the outcome of an election or the candidates and what their platforms are and things like that? Thank you, sir.
Good question. And my answer would be one word, immense. Because lobbyists are the conduit to money. A lobbyist's first obligation is to raise enough money that he can get in the office to speak to the administrative assistant. That's local and national. So a lobbyist is in the food chain. And because they represent certain groups, for example, a lobbyist, I'm just going to say the Medical Association or the National Rifle Association or AARP, they represent these people, and the candidate can't afford to offend huge blocks of votes. So every time he gives a speech, he's saying, now, how will the NRA react to this? How will the medical people react to this, et cetera? So the lobbyists have influence on both the message and the delivery of the message, which would be the money. Immense, and it's corrosive. I'm not anti-lobbyist. I think they serve a purpose. But the problem, the base problem we have in America is money, and they're part of the food chain.
How has the Citizens United decision affected American politics?
I think it's done great damage to America, and the Supreme Court should be ashamed what they've done. Now you have people like one person or two people, the Koch brothers, for example, in Texas are the best example I can think of, can control, well, now they're the funnel of money for the Tea Party. And the Tea Party's extreme right wing. And without the Koch brothers, the Tea Party probably would have great difficulty. Well, the problem with that is the Koch brothers then have their own philosophy and have what they want in the direction they want America to go. And they can have great influence on the people they give money to. And that's just the way it works. And I think it's a shame that corporate money's been allowed to come into the picture. Now, both sides use it. There a lot more, of course, went to the Republican side. But I think it's a shame. I think it weakens the process. There are two things I wish could happen, but the First Amendment gets in the way of it. One, a limit on campaign spending, which will never happen because of the First Amendment. The other thing is the length of the campaign. If we could limit, if we did nothing else, if we could limit the campaign as the British do to 90 days, we'd have a lot fewer problems. We'd spend a lot less money. People could govern for 4 years instead of 2 years before they start running again. House members, you know, can never quit raising money because they have to run every 2 years. So they spend more of their time raising money than they do the people's business.
Paula in Franklinton. Hi, Paula. You're on the air with Raymond Strother.
I have a comment about Bobby Jindal's talk to local news, or, you know, like you said. And I think it's because he does not want questions about what he's doing to our state. He's as close to a dictator as I've seen. And, you know, school voucher program, just the way the cutbacks he's done, I think he's not thinking long-term Louisiana.
All right, now, I don't know how closely you've – thank you, Paula. Raymond, you've followed this school voucher.
I couldn't hear that. Oh, she must be on a cell phone. Yeah. I apologize.
Well, the governor effectively pushed through an education plan in the last session, and it involved vouchers in which students in public schools could go to private schools, and it was struck down a couple of weeks ago by a Baton Rouge judge, Tim Kelly, who's a Republican, saying it was unconstitutional.
Yeah.
What do you think about the governor and his leadership style and his effectiveness in getting things done?
Well, I'm bothered by it, but of course, remember, let me go ahead and state, I'm a liberal, and I don't believe there should be a marriage of church and state. And I do not believe the state should give money to religious schools. I mean, there are too many religious schools. They shouldn't be even called schools. And I've seen some of them where people are getting this strange education where there is no such thing as evolution and the earth is 6,000 years old. Those shouldn't be schools. And what he's doing is he's playing politics there, because to win the nomination again, Republicans have to dip far, far, far to the right, to the extremists in their party. And a lot of the extremists in their party are from the religious community, religious right, fundamentalists. And fundamentalists won't help from the government. They want school vouchers. Well, that's government help, the help they scream about all the time. So I think it's terrible.
Rinaldi in Sherwood. Rinaldi, you're on the air with Ray Strother. Hi, Rinaldi.
Hey, how you doing, Jim? Mr. Strother, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a long political science admirer, but let me try and cover a couple of things. The Koch brothers put out a lot of money, but they didn't get many results. And I'm thinking part of that is because if you look at the Tea Party, when they've been the most effective, it's been in off-year elections, which are typically more conservative, lower turnout, older white voters. Whereas in this election, it was the converse, where you had, you know, a larger array of the American people turning out. And I want you to address one other thing, too, the voter suppression things. I think the Republican Party, and I always joke with a good friend of mine, Dr. Albert Samuels, he always says, you know, African Americans have been in this country for 400 years, and people still don't understand this. The voter suppression thing made people turn out even more so than they did, you know, than to deter them from turning out to vote.
All right. What about voter suppression and the Tea Party doing better in off-year elections, Ray? Thank you, Rinaldi.
First of all, let me say that the gentleman who just called is a political scientist, and he's a very wise man. There's always been an attempt at voter suppression. I remember back in the late 70s, early 80s, in elections in Louisiana, the Republicans would get people in vested suits with clipboards to go to a poll and just stand there with a pencil in black precincts. They weren't doing anything. That's called, it was just purely intimidation. When John Breaux was elected, Lee Atwater put together a campaign to disqualify a lot of black voters. They were trying to remove them from the rolls, as is done in Florida. Well, it backfired, because what it did is inflamed the minority community, and they voted in greater numbers than they did in Florida also. So there's always an attempt at voter suppression. There are people trying to take people off the rolls all over. And the people they're trying to take off the rolls are poor people, uneducated people, minorities, and immigrants.
Right. Well, Raymond, we've got to roll, but thank you so much. Great to join you today from beautiful Bozeman, Montana. Thanks, Raymond Strother.
Sure. Thank you.
Raymond Strother, the author of Falling Up, How a Redneck Helped Invent Political Consulting. Back in a minute. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. You may also reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest at this time is Howard Schatz. He is a well-known photographer, one of the most prolific photographers in our country, a man who began his career, Howard, I believe, as an ophthalmologist of note. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. I was a physician, and I was a retinal specialist in San Francisco for many years. Had a great interest in photography. We took a 1 year off of my medicine to come to New York as a sort of a sabbatical 17 years ago, and have had so much fun. It's been so interesting and so creatively joyous that I haven't looked back.
And you are a man who, as we lead into your latest work, you definitely have an eye for the capturing the human form.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Actually, At the Fights, this new book on American boxing, Inside the World of Professional Boxing, is my 19th book. About 10 years ago, I did a book on athletes, and I studied every athlete you could imagine, all the Olympic sports, swimming, gymnastics, track and field, judo, fencing, et cetera, and all the professional sports, football, baseball, basketball, hockey. And I found that boxers, although they have the same qualities as all the other athletes in their God-given physical gifts, their ability to work hard, take coaching, self-sacrifice, focus, they had also this incredible courage. They're defeated emotionally by nothing. They can't be crushed. Their spirit can't be held down. They can't be dominated over. They can't be controlled. They overcome adversity by getting up after getting knocked down and getting up again after getting knocked down. And they choose a sport which they fight people whose careers are advanced by trying to knock them out. It's sort of incredible. And so I set upon the journey of studying American boxing, because I was in awe of their courage. And this six-year journey has been a great privilege, and it's been fascinating. I've gotten to photograph and interview every champ from every weight class. And I believe we sort of get an insight into this rare human quality of courage from these individuals.
The book is At the Fights, Inside the World of Professional Boxing from Howard Schatz. And this is one of the most prodigious books I've ever picked up. I get a workout just carrying it down the hall, Howard.
Yeah. You know, I think it is 8 or 9 pounds. Sports Illustrated came to me. They had seen my work. They knew my work. And, of course, I photographed Sports Illustrated. And I photographed lots of the championship fights from ringside all over the country. But they came to me and said, nobody but Sports Illustrated should be publishing this book. I mean, they sort of insisted, which was a great honor to have Sports and Time Life books behind this. They made a beautiful book with thick pages and great printing. The main thing was, before I started this project, I studied everything I could about boxing. I wanted to make images that were unique, that were never seen before. I wanted people to open the pages and go, oh, my God, I've never quite seen any photograph or art or anything like that looks like this. And that was my goal. So I studied everything that had been done in sports and boxing beforehand. And as well, I then interviewed all the important people in boxing, 100, 150 people who are not boxers, such as managers and promoters and commissioners, judges, refs, trainers, writers, TV analysts, even retired boxers. I wanted to learn all about the business and culture of boxing, and I wanted to make pictures that said, this is a boxer. This is human, and it's power, and it's violent, and it's vulnerable, and it's all sorts of things, and that's what I try to do with these pictures.
There are a collection of memorable photographs, but on a few of the pages you have before and after photos that you took of fighters before they got in the ring and after. And talk about a picture saying 1,000 words. It's all right there in their faces.
Yeah, you're really compelled to look at that, aren't you? I mean, there isn't anybody that has looked at this work, it hasn't commented on it. Even that first picture, you see the fire and determination in the eyes of a boxer about to fight for a 12-round fight for a championship. And then when it's over, you can see what he's gone through. You can see a lifetime of toughness that he's gone through. It's quite interesting. The promoters were very generous to us. And the head of boxing, New York State Athletic Commission, allowed me access to the locker rooms and backstage and everywhere. So I was able to really see boxing from every angle and photograph everything about it, from, you know, the gyms and working out and training and the taping and everything. And in this book is everything, the celebration of winning and the defeat and despair of losing. What two boxers go through, how they fall into each other's arms after a fight, is sort of an intimate embrace, recognizing what the two of them have gone through. It's a really quite a fascinating sport, and I did everything I could to bring the life and spirit of this sport into these images.
There's no sport quite like it, is there?
I don't think so. I mean, it's really sort of remarkable, and I think it's rare individuals. I mean, somebody who wants to be a boxer who doesn't have this kind of courage usually lasts a half a round. And I've seen it happen. Kids very determined, they get into the ring with somebody who's really determined, and they get a hit a few times, they start to protect themselves, and they sort of really give up and quit. A boxer really learns who he is once he's in a fight with an adversary who is learning who he is. And I did everything I could to depict that in this book. This book has gotten a great attention all over the world, actually, already in the last few months that it's been out. And it's available in all the bookstores as well as Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, At the Fights.
At the Fights from Howard Schatz, a guy with an eye and for sight, having been an ophthalmologist and now one of the world's most prodigious and prolific photographers. And you capture not only fighters, but people who are around the fight game. One of the most captivating photos in the book, I think, is of the ring announcer, Michael Buffer.
Yeah. You know, I made friends with everybody. You know, everybody was generous. It's sort of a small family, this boxing business. They all know each other. They all are, they have break bread together. Mm-hmm. Buffer's been really nice and really generous. It was really helpful to me. There wasn't anybody that I met that was, after I made a portrait and did an interview, who then didn't want to help me, who said, I can get you this champ, or I can get you that champ, or I can get you into this and that. So everybody was really, really great. In a way, this whole book is a collaborative and cumulative effort from many people who were helpful. And I feel that the book is not only a book of great boxing photographs, but I think anybody who loves great photography and great art and great images of athletes and the musculoskeletal system and real humanity would enjoy looking at the images in this book.
We have a listener who asks, Darren, who wants to know if you think boxing should be abolished considering the damage that obviously has been inflicted on so many great champions.
It is a violent and brutal sport, and it was a tough journey for me, having been, as a trained physician, programmed to abhor any activity that hurt the brain. So I understand that argument. And, as we go through life, we all lose a little bit of something. And boxers don't quite revere what their intellect can do the same way if somebody comes up in a family who's told by their parents to become well-educated. But for me, I was able to navigate this ambivalence by falling in love with the boxers. You really get a feeling for them. They had great stories. And there's Edwin Rodriguez, who's a great super middleweight, and one day will be great champ. He and his wife had twins who were very premature, about a pound and a half. And these two little kids have had every kind of problem you can imagine, and from tough. You can't walk, eat by themselves, take care of themselves. And this young couple has gone through every dime they have to rehabilitate these kids. And he told me the only time he has serenity, the only time he has peace, the only time he's really happy and really relaxed is when he's in the ring fighting.
Mm. Philip and Ponce.
There are many stories like that.
Philip, you're on the air with Dr. Howard Schatz. His book is At the Fights.
Well, I think the doctor has selected a very worthy subject, and I think he's described why it's a worthy subject very well. He mentioned some things, brutality and determination, that are part of boxing. I wonder about his opinion of what I consider one of the great sports photographs, and that's the one of Rocky Marciano landing the knockout punch on Jersey Joe Walcott.
Well, before I did this book, I studied every boxing photograph that had been in existence that I could find, and that's a tremendously powerful photograph. And my mission was to try to make images every bit as good as that, and then a step further than that. So I worked in my studio. I mean, I did shoot from ringside. There's real photojournalistic imagery throughout this book, but the heart and soul of my book are in the photographs in the studio, in which I was able to use all sorts of intricate lighting and photographic techniques to depict power and violence, brutality and focus, vulnerability and humanity. It was a great challenge and a great journey and a great mission, and I feel that with the collaboration of each boxer that I work with, that we were able to achieve images every bit as meaningful as that image that you bring up.
Where did you take the photo that is in the book? It is a captivating photograph of Muhammad Ali.
Ali came to my studio. We find this very interesting. When his limousine, we live in Soho, when his limousine came to our studio, we're on the second floor, I looked out the window. He stepped out. Within 5 seconds, there was a crowd of 100 people around him. You know, he just attracts the world. When Vladimir Klitschko came to the studio, he's held the heavyweight championship longer than any heavyweight ever. Vladimir Klitschko from the Ukraine, who lives in Germany, who has every bit of the same attention in Europe as Ali did all over the world. He was early, and I looked out my window, and there he was across the street on a cell phone making a call, leaning against a, you know, a store door, and people passed by and nobody recognized him. It's quite interesting. So, but all the images were made in the studio, and the thing about my photography is I shoot to surprise and delight and amaze myself. I mean, that's my goal. I look through the camera and I say, I've seen that before. How can I see it differently? I've done that before, or this has been done before. How can I do it differently? And that was my goal, is to make images that were original and unique and magnificent and compelling to look at. And that's what I did in the 6 years, and I feel like was a great luck and great privilege to do so.
In the photograph you have of Mike Tyson, and what a photograph it is, three words that he states prior to the photo being unveiled, he says, or maybe four words, "I'm a predator." That describes him, and what a shot you got of him, Howard Schatz.
Yeah. I was sent by Sports Illustrated 2 years ago to photograph him in Las Vegas for their series they're doing called Where Are They Now? And I did an extensive interview. He's really smart and very giving and generous in his interview and real interesting. And he recognizes that he was a predator. He was a monster. But following that image of a scowl, which he gave me, you know, I asked him, let's fool around. I feel like we've made great pictures. Let's try to make, we'll make some mistakes. We'll see where we go. And he gave me that. Within 1 minute, he called Milan and his 1.5-year-old daughter, who was there with Tyson, with their mother, Tyson's wife, came running up to him. And he picked her up in his arms. And there you have a true, loving, affectionate father-daughter picture, which I also put in the book. It's near the back of the book. So he's a real person, and he's found his way to sort of live a life that's more acceptable in society in some of the ways he's lived before.
I love the picture you have of Joe Frazier. It must have been taken shortly before he died.
It was. It was the last picture he's had. He died a few weeks after that. He was a gallant, elegant man who was quite clear-minded and gave a real interesting interview, and it was fun to make a serious portrait that had veracity, that had truth, that showed. My goal was to try to show his life in an image. And you could see the lines and the character and the feeling and his hands in that image. I felt very proud of that image. It was a great experience.
The book is from Howard Schatz. It's called At the Fights. Jim Lampley, who writes the introduction, says Howard Schatz looks at fighters and sees the drama in their characters, bringing a sense of wonder and awe to boxing that enlivens all his photographs and invites us into a new appreciation of a world of pain, passion, and perseverance. And Larry Merchant of HBO says, Howard Schatz peers into the heart and soul of boxing, and I'm proud to be in his rogues gallery of non-combatants. Thank you so much, Howard.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. Really nice interview. I appreciate it very much.
Well, our pleasure. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And as we part company today, I did want to note that last Saturday, on the 8th of December, George Washington Eames, who was the longtime head of the NAACP in this area from 1980 to 1995. He died after a battle with cancer at his home with his wife of 35 years, Kathy, at his side. And George Eames was a warrior, and of course he was a soundbite machine and was on this show many times through the years. But he fought for good things for people in our community and has left a mark that is profound. And he lived as a man who was paralyzed, shot in the back on the 26th of March, 1956, in a segregated neighborhood at the corner of West Garfield and Highland near the LSU campus. He lived 57 years in a wheelchair, one of the longest living paraplegics in the world, when he died last Saturday at the age of 79. And services for George will be at 1 o'clock Saturday at the True Light Baptist Church at 3762 North Street. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow. And until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.